I would like to thank all of you for coming. This is related to my dissertation that I did at Dallas Seminary back in 2000. So I have an appendix within my dissertation on this, and this is largely excerpted from that with a bit of updating. We are aiming to publish on this. It would be part of a larger work related to my dissertation topic. You can follow on the website, as the first footnote indicates, for progress on publication. One of the big puzzles about codices versus scrolls is that in the first several centuries, only about 2% of all non-Christian manuscripts, papyrus manuscripts, are in codex form. But when it comes to New Testament manuscripts, about 96% of them in the first four centuries are in codex form. About 88%, some of which are clearly Christian in origin, but some seem to be Jewish in origin, 88% of them are in codex form, and about 70% of miscellaneous Christian manuscripts, non-scriptural, are also in codex form. And one of the big puzzlements within papyrology has been, why is there such a divergence in the number of codices versus the number of scrolls in the different bodies of literature? I think that we will get into that. So the question becomes, why did Christians adopt codices early, especially for biblical texts? Why did non-Christians slowly adopt this technology? Why was the percentage of codices for biblical manuscripts especially high? This paper argues that understanding early codex technology answers these questions and others. We have to get into how is it that papyrus scrolls themselves were made. Papyrus sold in standard 20-sheet rolls, not individual sheets. Pliny's statement, "there are never more than 20 sheets to a roll," refers to new papyrus as sold by producers. It was not sold in individual sheets, but individual sheets would be joined usually in units of 20, and so there was what was referred to as a standard scroll, which was the way that people would buy scrolls. Now, Luke's gospel, which would be about 32 feet long in a papyrus scroll and about 2.5 inches in diameter, would require 3 or 4 of these standard scrolls. So Pliny's statement deals with the unit of sale rather than the units as they would be constructed by users. It's also pertinent that Bruce Metzger argues, and he has a rather extensive set of proofs in the article that is mentioned here, that an accumulation of artistic, archaeological, and literary evidence shows that writing desks came late, not being popular until the 8th or 9th centuries. We explore this at length in my dissertation, but we have such puzzling statements as is quoted by Paraseglou. The scribe said, "I wrote this with my knee and my pen." Writing typically took place in the lap. They did not use writing desks. That's going to have a great deal of pertinence for the transition between scrolls and codices. Specifically, this gives a reason why the 35-foot length was a maximum. 35-foot length in a papyrus scroll translates to about 2.5 inches diameter. If you're looking at a narrow text that you're having to inscribe, that say a 2-inch or 2.5-inch column, and then you're having the gathers on the two sides, it becomes rather difficult if you have a large scroll to keep it balanced in your lap. So scribes are regularly shown as working with them in their laps. The book of Luke, which is the longest New Testament book, is almost the maximum effective length of a papyrus scroll and would be a primary reason for the division of Luke Acts into two separate volumes in order that it would be a manageable work. So now let's consider scribal practices with scrolls. Scribes wrote on pre-assembled rolls because papyrus was sold in rolls. Rolls were ready for use right from the factory. They wrote only on one side. If you can imagine, here we have a scroll that is set in the normal way that it would be used in one's lap, but can you imagine turning it upside down and trying to write on a scroll that is upside down? Therefore, Ezekiel 2:10, Zechariah 5:3, and Revelation, which speak of palimpsests, that is, manuscripts that are written on both sides, these are highly unusual, and those passages called attention to them simply because they are unusual. Scrolls were very simple. They came out like a computer printout, just one side, and they were simple, like having a continuous paper coming out of a printer. And the popularity today of software scroll mode programs shows the user-friendliness of scrolls. However, codices are quite different, complicating both manufacture of them and transcription. Interestingly enough, we're going to be able to demonstrate, and some of the footnotes show, that codices were made by cutting scrolls, because the raw material was purchased in scroll form, and they would cut the scroll up and use it for creating a codex. So the first production step is going to be the cutting and folding of papyrus sheets. Transcription was then the next step, while binding finished the process. However, binding dramatically affected codex transcription requirements. So we will reverse the order of binding and folding. So we'll present this in the order of cutting and folding, then binding, because that will define some of the parameters under which the scribes had to do their work. So let's first look at cutting and binding. Here we have on the left a segment of a papyrus scroll. This is showing that there are three individual sheets here. And what needs to happen for making a codex is that there would have to be a cutting of these pieces, but they would make sure that the line where they would be folded would not coincide with a join. If you have a point where you have glued together two separate sheets and you fold it right there, everything's going to break down. So they were very careful to make sure not to have a fold coincide. We have a little more detailed picture as figure one in the paper. Note number 7 refers to fiber evidence, where in looking at the papyrus in scrolls, or actually in codices, it is possible, when it has been well preserved, to see a continuity of fiber pieces and to see where the cuts actually took place in preparing to make codices out of scrolls. So the first production step was cutting and folding of papyrus sheets. Transcription followed, and so on and so forth. Under cutting and folding, blank rolls required cutting and folding as the first manufacturing step. It was not yet ready for transcription. By contrast, scroll books were immediately ready for inscription as purchased. Codex making was a value-adding procedure. Bad codex design or poor cutting and folding could ruin a perfectly good roll. Codices stretched ancient publishing technology. Cutters aimed at uniform page size, but spaced cut so that no sheet central fold coincided with roll joins, which would weaken them. Center folds convert flat sheets into two-leaf, four-page folded sheets. Cutting and folding are two aspects of one process. For codices, the meaning of the term sheet changed from that for scrolls. A roll sheet is the width between two joins, but a codex sheet is the width between two cuts. A leaf is the width between a cut and a fold. The central fold is the sine qua non of a true codex. If you're looking at a newspaper illustrates a codex where you have each sheet folds into four pages. By using both sides of the page, which now becomes something that is easy to do with a codex, we end up with a much more efficient use of papyrus. There was some loss of space for binding purposes, but there was a significant improvement, so that it was a 44% improvement in the utilization of papyrus to go to a codex rather than using a scroll. There are some lists of prices that are regarded as fairly accurate for various periods of time within the Roman Empire. The note number 11 makes reference to that. Scrolls, to buy a 20-sheet standard scroll at various times ran between 1 and 6 days' wages for a common laborer. Let's take the cheapest of those. 1 day's wages for a common laborer to end up with writing material that could handle between a fourth and a third of the book of Luke written on one side. This is a rather expensive process. So therefore, there was great interest in being able to make the use of papyrus more efficient. So that when you figure in transcription costs, as Skeet did in the article that is alluded to here, it amounts to about a 20%, 26% overall reduction in cost for turning out a codex of the same text as doing it in scroll form. Now, when all of this is carried out, the basic binding equation is one sheet equals two leaves equals four pages. So here we have a picture that will illustrate that. But the interesting thing here is we have a non-intuitive codex page order. If I take the outside sheet here for this codex, we have pages 1, 2, 15, and 16. It simply becomes a non-intuitive type of arrangement between the page order that results after binding compared to the page order as we are working with loose sheets. We are going to argue that the scribes worked with loose, unnumbered sheets as they went about their scribal procedures. So binding distinguishes sheet order from page order, yielding correct pagination in a simple reader sequence. However, sheet order prior to binding is daunting. It is especially difficult since, as the next page will argue, neither pages nor sheets were numbered at any point in manufacture or inscription. Imagine inscribing four unnumbered sheets to produce 16 bound pages in proper sequence, as in Figure 2. After cutting and folding ends, binding needs changed scribal procedures. We will discuss binding next, even though inscription preceded binding, because binding requirements imposed changes in scribal procedures. So let's look at binding. Although binding created the codex, it was also the weak link. Early codices were single choir. Single choir means that there's a single gathering. That was the initial way that codices were put together. Later on, they came up with the idea of having multiple gathers, multiple choir, but that didn't seem to develop until within the 4th century, approximately the same time as the move to parchment. And it was when you combined multiple choir and a change in writing material going to parchment that it became possible to have a book that would contain more than, say, Luke and John. P75 was actually stretching beyond the limits of technology, and as a result, the binding quickly failed and it lost pages on the outside and lost pages towards the inside. But when you had multiple choir plus the use of parchment, suddenly it became possible in the 4th century to have one binding containing an entire Bible, not just a portion of the Gospels. But as we're looking at the early experimentation, we are looking at single choir codices. So I start here with a quote, "One method practiced for a long time in spite of its disadvantages was to form a book out of a large number of superimposed sheets," and I add, "in a single choir. A book made up in this way, even if stiffened internally with bands of parchment, is liable to tear or break at the spine. Moreover, it is not easy to see into the middle pages along the fold." You know how sometimes you pick up a bound volume and you want to make photocopies, and there near the center it's difficult to read the text. Those types of difficulties developed because single choir codices, if they were relatively large, became pudgy and the pages sloped in rather steeply into the binding. Furthermore, outer and central sheets were quite vulnerable and tended to fall out. And so we illustrate here the difficulty in photocopying central pages of thick-bound periodicals illustrates this. Near the center margin, each page slopes steeply toward the binding, narrowing the margin and distorting characters. Binding gave birth to the codex, but also brought to birth pangs for both codex maker and scribe. Now we'll consider scribal procedures with codices. The codex created two new problems for scribes. Number one, transcribing material to the wrong sheet, creating transpositions, or incorrectly estimating the number of pages, wasting papyrus and time. We're going to argue that pages were not pre-bound. That is, they did their transcription into loose sheets. The evidence for that is that quite often there were pages that were botched in. When the scribe reaches the midpoint of his book, if he says, "Whoops, I've got more than half the material left," he drops in another page here, or another sheet. Well, let's say that he gets up here to page number 16, now actually page 20 as a result of adding an extra sheet, and he says, "I still have more to write." So he botches in another sheet at the end, and this became possibly the thing that led people to think in terms of multiple choir, because they would botch in at the end. If they are capable of botching in at the end, it proves that there was not pre-binding. Furthermore, if they pre-bound, necessarily scribes would have a hard time writing near the binding. So there would have been an extra wide margin. That is not the case. Furthermore, stitch holes sometimes penetrate through words. And all of these things show that binding did not occur prior to scribal work. Furthermore, we find that pages were not pre-numbered. Very few manuscripts have page or sheet or choir numbers. And if they are present, pagination is regularly in a different hand than the hand of the scribe. And furthermore, pagination can be shown to have happened in some manuscripts after the manuscript lost pages. So let's say, for example, we have a manuscript and it has numbering pages 5 through 12. And we say, well, that's nice, but we happen to know that the work started long before that. And so we say, well, if we were to assume that the complete manuscript were there, lo and behold, this is part of it, and we have lost some external pages. But lo and behold, when you figure all this out, it starts at section E and ends with section T of this particular book, and we say there was an A through X. So what happens is papyrologists are able to determine there are a number of manuscripts where pagination took place after the manuscript had lost pages. So it's a rather interesting set of criteria that we are able to determine just by examining the manuscripts themselves. So, let's now turn to page 4 of the notes. Since scribes did not use pre-bound codices, is it possible that they used pre-numbered sheets? And we say clearly that that was not the case. So, Turner says, normally the scribe did write these pages when the sheets were still detached before the volume was stitched. He says to keep his sheets in correct order without the help of pagination would have required the strict observance of a working routine. For example, only one sheet might have been removed from the bulk at any time, and after one leaf, front and back, had been copied, it might have been replaced before the next sheet was taken. It would be possible to verify that the sheets were still in the correct order for the binder at the moment that the scribe or the corrector collated the copy against the exemplar. I'm here going to suggest a procedure. Within the dotted rectangle would be where transcription takes place. So what we have is a blank set of pages, and we are looking at the recto, the front of the page, front of the sheet. It's immediately turned over, and the scribe would inscribe the right-hand portion of it. So I can hold this up to illustrate. What we have is it is initially set in this way, A, it's turned over, and the scribe fills in what would be page 1, then page 2, that's marked by C, and then he puts it face down. After he's gone through his stack and has inscribed what will be the left-hand sides of sheets, then he follows the procedures E through F, and he ends up filling in the second half. There's something very interesting about this. The scribe has to know when he is at the halfway point of his vorlaga that he is transcribing into this new copy. So the halfway point becomes something of extreme importance for him to know. Underestimating book length. Assume a scribe estimated a codex needed 20 sheets. Halfway through, he recalculates, adds another sheet. He begins inscribing the right-hand sides of sheets. Unfortunately, after filling in the last page, he still needs more space. He botches in a 22nd sheet. P75 and the papyrus symbol didn't print on my wife's computer. We haven't loaded that font in there. So that's P75. They're just kept writing progressively smaller to fit more and more text onto his page. So now with a comparison of scrolls and early codices. Codices reduce papyrus cost by using both sides, but required greater sophistication by those producing them. And he goes, Harris goes on to describe how initially they were experimenting, and the scribes and the producers of codices really hadn't worked out all the details. We can say that while the codex was reader-friendly based on relative costs and ease of use, it never became transcriber-friendly. Copyists adopted the codices, but what about authors? That's a major question. And what I would argue here is no author would ever think about creating his autograph on a codex. Because what author gets through these five sheets on the left-hand side and says, I know, I am exactly at the halfway point of my book. Now I can start working on the right-hand sides of these sheets. No author knows that in the process of creating his work. Scribes had difficulty, and all they had to do was look at their existing copy. But there were a number of variables. Page size was not going to be uniform. The scribe might end up having a larger line spacing. He might end up with larger print size. He might end up with smaller margins. All of these things created variables that made it difficult for scribes to estimate how is an author going to know I am at the halfway point as he's writing his work. So what I would argue for is we have codex copies, because the codex is a publishing tool that reduced the cost of copies. But I would presume that authors wrote their autographs on scrolls, because it's far easier to work with, and all you have to do is glue on some more and you can keep on going. Whereas in the case of Luke, you just do a second volume. So, this will bring us now to page number 5. We will have 3 issues that we're going to deal with. I'm going to consider the first and the third first. The division of Luke, Acts into 2 volumes. That's been written on at length by a number of authors. The very fact that the book of Luke is stretching the size of a scroll that could be used in the lap seems to be a major reason why he would divide his work into 2 separate works. I'm not going to talk much about loss of sheets versus loss of pages and the ending of Mark, but a few people have proposed that maybe what happened was some manuscript dropped out an ending. That doesn't work very well, because if it's dropping out the ending, you're going to expect it to drop out a beginning. Simply because when codices lose sheets, it's not just the pages at the end, it's going to be sheets covering beginning and end. So knowing a little bit about the technology does help with that issue. But now I'm going to go into what may seem to be a bit of a digression, but this is the reason that my dissertation is interested in the topic of scrolls. I wrote a synoptic order and content dissertation. William Farmer asked a question, which we have here at the bottom. Why does Matthew usually support Mark in order and content when the order or content of Mark is deserted by Luke? This is assuming, of course, the Markan hypothesis. And why should Luke, in a similar way, support Mark in order and content when the order or content of Mark is deserted by Matthew? We can illustrate that by saying, imagine that someone were going to do a statistical study of birth order and gender of twins. And imagine that the person imagined that all twins were identical. Well, then it would be a study of a pair of boys or a pair of girls. And that wouldn't be a very meaningful statistical study. The correlation wouldn't yield much of any interest. Interestingly, when Markan hypothesis have sought to interact with Farmer, they have often understood Farmer to be talking about identical twin departures. That is, that he was looking, they thought, at places where both Matthew and Luke would transpose, or both Matthew and Luke would omit. But Farmer, who is the third reader on my dissertation, was not arguing for that at all. He was looking at all kinds of twins. So if we're looking at the twin births, the older could be a boy and the younger a girl, or the older could be a girl and the younger could be a boy. In other words, Farmer was also looking for occasions when Matthew might be seen to transpose Mark on the same passage that Luke omits, or that Matthew omits and Luke transposes. Interestingly enough, Streeter, in his magisterial work, said that in the first half of Matthew, that Matthew prefers to transpose but occasionally omits, and Luke prefers to omit but occasionally transposes. And you look at that and you say, why is it that we don't find a single passage, depending on where a person puts the Sermon on the Mount relative to the outline of Mark, we may find one or two or zero places where there is a transposition by Matthew and an omission by Luke, or vice versa. And I will argue that it actually is statistically underrepresented. It's statistically significant. Okay, if we set up a three-way grid, what we end up with here is nine possibilities. Up in the upper left, we have no departure by either Matthew or Mark, or Matthew or Luke. And then the other cells that are black have only one gospel departs from Mark. In the very center, I have marked the double omission in a separate color because one might say it's an endangered species. It's not all that common, but it's not nearly as extinct as the other three cells. This is essentially what Farmer was looking at. And what I would say is, although some people have tried to allege that this is neo-Lachmannianism, that there would be a Lachmannian fallacy in the sense that they thought that it's totally reversible, it is not totally reversible. Why is it that it is not reversible? If we look at it from the standpoint of the Markan hypothesis, there is a deficit of twin departures at the low end of statistically significant. In other words, it's a statistical problem. But on the other hand, if we assume the two gospel hypothesis, which has Mark as the third gospel being aware of Matthew and Luke, Mark is seen to follow the order and the content of whichever predecessor he is using as his guide. In that case, transpositional kinds of twin departures, where either both transpose or Matthew transposes and Luke omits, I put all of these in quotation marks because the sequence, this isn't exactly the right terminology because Matthew and Luke would precede Mark rather than following him. These would be rare. But double omissions would only have the level of frequency with which Mark added singular content. So my challenge is that the Markan hypothesis needs to come up with a rational explanation for the rarity of twin departures. But on the other hand, the two gospel hypothesis is able to say it's exactly what we expect from what we say Mark does. He follows the order and the content of a predecessor. What I say in conclusion is scroll autographs are significant in terms of the division of Luke Acts into two volumes, the fact that Farmer's issue of the rarity of twin departures would have a reasonable basis for seeing how it happens, and it does deal with the ending of Mark as far as ruling out some possibilities of explanation. But then we have another conclusion, and that is that why is it that Christians love the Codex. And secular works tended to be very slow to adopt it. Well, the fact that non-Christian writings of the first centuries almost never appear in Codex form, but Christian works, especially Scripture, and most especially the New Testament, indicate that, number one, Christians sought to produce copies in quantity. When you have large numbers of copies, if you can cut down the cost, it becomes a major reason to go through the trouble of creating a codex. If you're not producing large numbers of copies, why bother? And then they were looking for ways to reduce costs. So we've seen the statistics of about 0.5% of non-Christian works in the first four centuries being in codex form, but the overwhelming preponderance of extant papyrus manuscripts of the first three centuries in Christian settings being in codex form. Thank you very much. Any questions? Yes.
So, how early again did the codices begin?
Okay, very good. I alluded on the top of page 5 to a citation of Marshall. He was a Latin writer about the year 85, and he makes the first apparent reference to a codex. He was talking about travelers being able to take his work in a form that he describes, and it sounds like the codex. And so it's much more compact, easier for travelers to carry. But what I argued in my dissertation is that argument from silence, we're not able to say that the New Testament writers were or were not familiar, but I would argue that the codex was so unfriendly that it would be something that you would relegate to scribes rather than for an author himself to burden himself with such a thing. The fact that we have very early manuscripts, and of course the Bodmer Papyrus being dated very early within the second century, points to Christianity saying, hey, this is a good tool to be able to cut cost. One of the things that's interesting about New Testament manuscripts compared to secular manuscripts is that the size of the writing tends to be somewhat larger, but we see evidence of first century churches meeting at night when slaves would be able to get away and be able to meet. So if you're having to use torches and other things like that, smallness of print is not the easiest way to accomplish what they were aiming at. So they needed to look at ways of being able to make the use of papyrus efficient. And of course, one other benefit that I haven't talked about at all is that with a codex, we have random access, whereas with a scroll, you have sequential access. So there ended up being a lot of benefits for the codex that encouraged its usage. But one other thing that I would add is that I think that as we think about the hermeneutics of the authors, there's a little different dynamic as far as looking for parallel passages. Because actually consulting them is very easy with codex for us, but if the authors were thinking scrolls, it's a little different dynamic. There are a lot of interesting ramifications. I think that it also starts pointing us in some interesting directions on canonicity. Because when you look at the cost involved in creating manuscripts, and you look at the huge volumes of manuscripts that we have, I think the church was putting its money in the books it wanted. And, we're looking at them seeking ways to keep the costs down, but yet the huge numbers of manuscripts that we have found that have been edited compared to the number that were created that we haven't found or haven't yet gotten to editing. Yeah, I mean, it's just astounding to look at the amount of investment that they put into the text. I mean, I find this whole issue of scrolls and codices to just have a lot of trajectories that go in very interesting directions. Any other questions? Yes?
It might be ignorant, but do we have any scrolls that represent manuscripts that we have?
We have a couple, but actually the very first quote, second footnote here, I'll say the point A, there are 129, the one that I want is B, 71 out of 74 New Testament manuscripts. This particular book, The Birth of the Codex by Roberts and Skeet, analyzes these, and they would say that really it's a smaller number than the three, in the sense that when governmental agencies used papyrus, they would use one side. And then it seems that the Verso showed up as scrap paper, recycled paper, and there are a couple of manuscripts that are written on the Verso of something that has another document, either a government document or some secular work on the Recto. And so, in a sense, that isn't a true codex, because what they had was probably very cheap writing material. But there are a few manuscripts, but it's exceedingly rare. And a hallmark of scrolls is that if you find writing on the opposite side, it is normally of a different work, which is showing recycling rather than by design. We have a few passages in the Bible that refer to palimpsest, but writing on both sides is an extremely difficult thing to do with papyrus, and there's a further difficulty. Papyrus went together in two plies, and so you would have papyrus with the fibers running one direction and running the other direction. They wanted the lengthwise fibers to be on the outside of the circle. If you tried to wind a papyrus scroll the opposite way, it would start breaking very quickly, because this motion would cause a separation of those fibers that are going parallel to the roll. So, yeah, there's a lot here. I mean, this is just an absolutely fascinating interaction between technology and a desire to get the word out. And but the issue of the central binding is, at one point, the sine qua non of a codex, it's also the weak point within it, and it's what made it hard for the scribes to work with. And, I mean, it's just an absolutely fascinating thing to me, how all of this interacts. Yes?
My understanding is that they may have changed eight ends because of papyrus, or just that it's hard to write on that?
Well, writing went across joins and so on and so forth. You know, they had been used to working with relatively rough materials for a long time. I've got a sheet of papyrus, but I think it's still in Denver. I didn't end up bringing it on this trip. It's modern papyrus, of course. Well, thank you very much.